The Business on RTÉ Radio 1 with AIB. We know that your focus is on your business. That's why ours is on supporting you.
Now, to the story of a Dundalk man who went from working in a meat factory in Belfast to creating inflatable shamrocks for Irish football fans to selling his company, pigsback.com, for millions. He's just published a memoir of his time in business, and it's called From the Arena. Michael Dwyer, you're very welcome to the show. The name From the Arena for a business memoir conjures up ideas of the gladiatorial arena. Where did the name come from? Is that what you had in mind?
Well, so it should. No, it's actually based on Theodore Roosevelt's famous address to the Sorbonne in 1910, known as Citizenship in the Republic. But the most famous passage in that speech was the man in the arena. And he basically, Roosevelt respected the guy who was in the arena, and to be in the arena is to struggle, to fight, to err, to make mistakes, to get bruised and blooded, but to get up again and go again. And, you know.
And is that what entrepreneurship is about?
I think that's exactly what it's about. I think we're encouraged to write our business plans, and we dot the I's and we cross the T's, and we write it with great certainty because paper, after all, takes ink. But it's the unanticipatable challenges that come to get us and come to bite us, you know.
And do you think that there's something about the personality of the entrepreneur? Lots of people, very different personalities, but that there might be common traits there, that some people are just drawn to that.
Well, I suspected that was the case. And I actually delved into it a bit and looked at a few academic studies. And it turns out, Richard, that entrepreneurs are a bit more tapped than the population on average. The average person in the population, according to a particular study in the United States, suffers 48% suffer one mental illness or condition, behavioural condition, ADD, ADHD, addiction disorders, stresses of various kinds. But the entrepreneurs, they boast 72%. That's 52% higher, or 50% higher, I should say. So I think to entrepreneurs, there's an attraction, there's a place for their obsessiveness. There's something that they can dive very deeply into, and that's what they do. They
engage. Do you think they have to be obsessive?
I think it certainly helps. The entrepreneur isn't sitting with the average levels of creativity and inventiveness. They want to change the world. They want to do things that are very different. To do that involves absolute commitment and, yes, obsession.
One of the things that always struck me about the entrepreneurial mindset or people who are very, you know, dedicated and driven to do that is, unlike me, they seem to enjoy when things go wrong. Because if you're actually starting a business and you're running a business, stuff's going to go wrong every day.
Yeah.
I don't like a lot of things going wrong. They not only are good at dealing with that, they almost seem to enjoy that.
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. I remember a period where myself and my co-founder, Johnny Mack, John McDonald, you know, we were going through one challenge after another. And then suddenly we hit a period of calm, and it really was like we missed it. You know, how strange is that? But there's a high and an edge in these battles too. But I guess when they are just one following another and another and another, they do wear us down in the end.
When you talk about ups and downs and battling and stuff, did you have a lot of those ups and downs?
Massively.
Or mistakes, I suppose, is the first thing.
I would say both. I mean, first of all, you know, the business model I took on was a very ambitious one. It required that we win both at consumer level.
So just maybe explain what pigsback.com.
Yeah, I suppose these days people would call Pigsback a marketplace. Pigsback is like a gatekeeper between the consumers, the public out there who sign up for their special offers and whatever not. And on the other hand, the brands who want to reach the public but do it effectively. But that demands, in business model terms, that we win at both ends, that we win with the consumers and we win with the brands. And back in 2000, it also meant that we had to develop our own technology, which was an enormous challenge. You know, these days we can plug into Shopify or, you know, there are so many what they call SaaS models, as we know, out there. You know, they simply weren't in existence back then. So technology was a huge challenge. And of course, funding was a massive challenge as well.
And not many people necessarily had good internet access, did they?
I
remember that dial-up sound.
Absolutely. I mean, try downloading a movie on that, you know, it just can't be done. But, you know, we knew we had to get ahead of things nonetheless. You know, 1 in 7 households at the time had internet, Richard, so you're quite right. It was narrowband internet. And the only place people got any bit of speed at all on their internet was at work. And that's predominantly where people surf the internet. But, you know, we decided to dive in anyway, because that's what you do. But
and you went into Canada at one stage.
Yeah,
and that was a
right.
bit of a bit of a baptism.
So yeah, well, we started in Ireland and bang, we hit the dot com bust. So it went from boom to burst. So that was one thing. Then we raised significant money in the UK. But in November 2006, we were somewhere between optimism and pessimism in the UK, but we got a call out of the blue, and it was, "Hi, Michael, I'm Sean O'Leary. I'm the vice president of Bell New Ventures in Canada. We're Canada's largest corporation, and we see Pigsback as the future of smart advertising in North America." And I'm going, "You do, Sean, do you? Tell me more." And within months, we signed a franchising agreement, and they were planning to spend €30 million, or dollars, I should say, on the rollout of Pigsback in Canada after a test in Calgary, and subsequently planning to spend up to $200 million on the rollout in the States. But a year later, guess what? Another one of these unanticipatable challenges. I got called aside by Sean. He said, "Michael, I'm afraid I've got some bad news, but Bell have just agreed to a merger with TELUS. It's the world's largest leveraged buyout or merger that has happened." A year subsequent to that, it didn't get through due diligence, but straight away they put a line through anything that was consuming cash, and that meant all new ventures, including Pigsback.
So no more, it wasn't going to happen.
It wasn't going to happen, no one. I mean, you know, we had sent out my main executive, a guy called Gareth Lamb, who went on to head up Meta in Ireland. He left with his wife Deirdre, their young child, and Deirdre was expecting their second. They went to Canada. We sent 6 secondees over there, but no, we had to, you know, turn back to Ireland, face into the credit crunch in the UK, and face into what became an absolutely buckling economic situation with the obviously property based depression in Ireland.
How did you cope with all that, Michael? I mean, that's pretty stressful stuff when something like that goes wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with difficulty is the answer, but I was blessed really to have a home life that distracted me and a wife who wouldn't indulge my bringing business problems home, and how correct she was. She was a very supportive wife on the business front and understood entrepreneurship, and that served us both really well through the journey. But the kids demand full attention. I jogged lots. I read lots and lots. My normal fare were smaller books, but suddenly
It wouldn't be good for the heart, that kind of stress, though.
No, you're right. And guess what? I developed cardiac arrhythmia over that period, and my doctor had a few severe words with me. But, you know, I gave up caffeine and I jogged more and I read more and I tried to find a bit of mindfulness in everything I was doing. And somehow or other, you know, you face one challenge at one fence at a time. If you're going to win the Grand National, well, you've just got to jump the fence in front of you, and then the next one, and then the one after that.
And did you find it easy to try and put it out of your head for a period, just to try and relax? Because it's not just about a job, you know, it's not just about, I have a job and this is not going well, or I'm in a stressful situation in the job. You're heavily invested personally in the outcome, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, the answer to that is no, I found it very, very difficult. But at the same time, I worked very, very hard on it. You know, there were an awful lot of people depending on me, everybody within the organization, anybody who'd put money into the company. And, you know, you were kind of conscious that the public was well bought into this brand. We had painted Ireland pink. You know, we had somewhere in the region of 1 million members in Ireland, people who registered at one point or another. So there was a lot hanging on it. And there was no other show in town for me, Richard. I simply had to make it work.
Why? But that's the thing. You know, what is it? Would you be afraid that if it didn't work out, there's a financial cost? Is it about feeling I have failed, I haven't done this right? You know, what is the driving force?
I think it's all of the above. You know, I think that the mess that would have been left behind had we failed would have been too much. Had we attempted, a clever and maybe tidy restructure, that would have been an option. You know, today, thankfully for small companies, there's the SCARP program, which is a tidy administration program for companies who are viable but who have built up legacy balance sheet issues. So had we that option, we may well have gone down that road, but we really feared reputation damage. And I tried to avoid it at all costs.
And you worked through it. And of course, you know, the story has a very happy ending because you ended up selling the company.
That's right, yeah.
Now, well, how much did you sell it for? How much did you make, Michael?
Well, you know, the reports at the time were that
the reports
business,
at the time, that were the accurate reports?
The business, yeah. Well, the business was sold for 25 million and I'm not in a position to refute that.
Right. So you would have done very well out of it and that had all paid off ultimately.
Yeah, no,
ultimately
it did. And what actually gave me the most satisfaction, and I really mean this with 100% sincerity, was to see our team do very well out of it. You know, the team... They got rewarded for their forbearance, for their commitment over the years, and they had to, and that's something that I fought for. But I was really, really pleased to hear talk of extensions, talk of people, some people at the higher end paying off their mortgages, you know, other people just changing their car, but just the delight at that win, and that's the way it should be. It was right.
Now, I want to just go back as to how you may have ended up setting up a company and being very driven about making that work, even in bad times as well as good. Your very first job was in the meat business in Belfast. You were a young man.
I know, indeed, yeah. I mean, I studied international marketing and languages at a college called NAT, the National Institute for Higher Education in Dublin. And it was the first year of that course, the second year of that college.
NIHE, which became
NIHE,
DCU.
Which is now DCU, correct, yeah. But and my major, like my thesis was on the subject of branding. But, you know, the 80s being the 80s, a job was offered to me as a trainee merchant trader in a meat company. And I accepted it. I lasted all of 14 weeks, Richard. Not that I didn't actually enjoy the trading side of things, but Northern Ireland at the time was a very different place. You know, we've done business in it since and it's a super place now. It's a transformed place and please God, it will stay that way. But I remember one weekend coming back up and there'd been an arson attack on our house, which was based on the meat plant. And I went through security to be greeted by Jimmy, who's a lovely old man. But he said to me, Michael, there's been an attack on your house. Someone tried to burn it down. And I said, well, are you coming up with me, Jimmy? He says, no, but here's a torch. So I went up anyway, up this lane, and not feeling very good about life. And I walked into the house and there was a smell of smoke around the place. But, you know, the garage attached to the house had been burnt out. And next thing the phone rang, you know, I was in utter darkness. And I picked up the phone and I heard, this is the UDA. You have 10 minutes to leave the premises. And I was thinking to myself, I'll be gone in 2 minutes, less, right, you know. But I looked down and, of course, the phone was an extension that had to come through security. And I hear a giggle at the other end and I said, Michael, it's Jimmy. Just ring it to say the trip switch is in the hot press. I think I got you there. And I said, you got me, oh, all right, Jimmy.
I'd say you loved anyway, me for that, all right.
The next day I stayed with a friend of mine, Peter Lynch. I rang Peter. His parents lived in Belfast. I stayed with his parents that night. And his father gave me some sage advice. And I went in and gave my notice. And a month later, I joined W&R Jacob for 6 very, very happy years on the Belgard Road.
And Jacob's was about marketing for you. The job's all about marketing. And tell me about the inflatable shamrocks.
Yeah, well, you know, look, typical me, I tend to get myself into a bit of trouble here and there. You know, I wanted something different for the World Cup. You know, I didn't want scarves and hats. And eventually I got a call from Noel King, who's well known in FAI circles. And he said, I've got a great idea. Would you meet me? And we met for tea and a bun in Bewley's and Grafton Street. And Noel said, I've got this idea for an inflatable shamrock. He said, they're all on about inflatable bananas. Let's own it with the inflatable shamrock. But Noel was very clever. He said, you just give me a small fee for the idea, and he walked away. So I was left to source it. But we all loved the idea in Jacob. So we gave a guy who had a sourcing company responsibility to source the shamrocks. And meanwhile, we manufactured 5, 6, 7 million packs with shamrocks all over them in Jacob's. So then my sorcerer arrived with his shamrock, and it turned out it was more akin to a crucifix than a shamrock. I said, that's not a shamrock, it's a crucifix. He said, well, in Hong Kong and Chinese, that they don't know what a shamrock is. He got his marching orders. And thankfully, a few weeks later, I got a leaflet through the poster a few days later from Donny Butler, who was then the commercial director of the FAI, and ended up taking a flight to meet a man of Pakistani origin on the outskirts of Manchester, and he was making inflatables. He had a very acceptable prototype ready for me. He got an order for his troubles.
Everything.
For 10,000 inflatable shamrocks. Not and off right. we went.
And basically loads of people got this through Jacobs.
That's
coupons
it, yeah.
or whatever.
Collect your 10 stickers from the packs and send them in to us, and on we went. And there was a young journalist at the time called Matt Cooper, no less, who wrote an article in the Sunday Tribune which read, "Shamrocks inflate Jacob's sales." And on we marched.
And you ended up then working in Paris.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. So Jacobs was taken over by a French company called Danone. And Danone had a biscuit division, obviously. So they were interested in building their leadership position across Europe. So thankfully, I was given the opportunity to go to Paris. And a young colleague of mine, a certain Karen Scanlon, who would become my wife, also moved to Paris about a year later in the International Product Development Division. And we had three great years, absolutely super years in Paris. But
romance bloomed in Paris.
Romance bloomed in Paris. Indeed it did. Yeah. In fact, the last project we worked on in Dublin, I always laugh at this, was the launch of the Lou brand, which is a French biscuit brand. And it told the story of Monsieur Lefebvre and Mademoiselle Utile, who met and married and made biscuits.
That one has stuck with you, Michael.
Indeed it has.
And you came back to Ireland and you worked with Green Isle Foods. And it was while working with Green Isle Foods that you thought about setting up
pigsback.com. I mean, Green Isle was a very successful company, very well invested company. And you know, I don't think I've worked with that calibre of management in I hadn't, at least in any other company, you know. They really were able to attract the best managers. Now, it was also quite an aggressive culture, you know. So, and that's the nature of a lot of these big companies. It's what they
it's
do.
It's very commercial. You know? It's very commercial.
Very commercial. Yeah. I mean, the digital multinationals these days wouldn't be any different. You know, they appear all rosy from the outside, but if you're being subjected to sort of quarterly reviews, 360-degree reviews, you know, by your boss, the people under you, the people to the side of you, etc., there's an awful lot of pressure. But in the early months with Green Isle, I really felt that pressure. I felt very exposed and wasn't at all sure that I was going to succeed here. I mean, I did. I joined the board a number of months later. But at that time, I felt extremely exposed. I was worried for my career. I was worried for my family. And I said to myself, look, Michael, do what it takes here. But at the next opportunity, take control of your own destiny, set up your own business. Now, I should say, Richard, that notion of control that we entrepreneurs strive for is utterly delusional.
You have no control.
We have no control over these macroeconomic events in particular that can, you know, happen in an instant.
But the thing about it was, when you hit on the idea, the dot-com bubble was happening, you set up pigsback.com and the dot-com crash came.
That's right.
How close together was the crash to when you set up the company?
Well, I on the 25th of November 1999, I was reading a book by an author called Seth Godin on what was called permission marketing. And I loved his thesis on what needed to be done to sort of succeed in internet marketing. And I developed it later into what I called empathy marketing, actually drawing on Fergal Quinn, who was a great man for the Shanuckle, Eisht le Fuam na Haun agus Yoitu Brach, roughly translated, listen to the sound of the river and you'll catch a fish. So he sought empathy with his consumers. And we set up empathy marketing and we ran these principles. So that was that. So, you know, managed to raise a few quid, etc., etc. Dot-com was going well. And then as I literally drove out of the gates of Green Isle, a few days later, the dot-com bubble burst and there was a massive crash and a huge loss of investor sentiment, investor positivity towards the space. Investors literally scarpered from the space. And I could sense it in my own investors, and I could not blame them, but regret that they had kind of, you know, fallen, if you like, for this whole trend. And my mother's words were in my ears, oh, you left that secure job, that good salary, that company car to go off on your own.
So you were battling from day one with it, and then you would have had other ups and other downs, and eventually, obviously, with the success of the business and selling it on in 2019. When you look back, Michael, at it all, I presume you're glad overall that you did what you did and you went into business.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that's sort of the central thesis or perhaps a main thing that I would have observed is that for all the difficulties, and I think this is true of life generally, you know, for all the difficulties, if we feel we're destined to do something and if that's our heart's desire, we should pursue it, but try to pursue it with our eyes open and be ready for those struggles. And I'd also say to particularly aspiring entrepreneurs, be sure your partner gets it. Be sure your partner is on board, because the divorce rate, guess what, among entrepreneurs is very, very high.
It's very high. I don't doubt it. Michael Dwyer, founder of pigsback.com and author of From the Arena. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.